Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a call to action for Black leaders in Phoenix after the beating of a Black man by Phoenix PD.
And why so many people are willing to experiment with different scents.
But first, Arizona and much of the West are dealing with drought and have been for years. Meanwhile, other parts of the country, especially on the East Coast, are facing flooding. So why can't there be a solution to the seeming mismatch of too much rain in places that can't handle it and not enough rain in places that really need it? With me now to explain is Alex Hager of KUNC in Colorado, who's been researching this. Hey, Alex.
Good morning, Mark.
So, like, how big of a topic of conversation is this in the water world of the fact that, you know, there are places on the East Coast, especially after these two recent huge hurricanes, that are facing terrible flooding, and us here in the West don't have nearly enough water?
Yeah, it is one that does not go away because it is such a tantalizingly simple solution. This topic is something that I would get a ton of emails about even before I ever published this story.
Okay.
I had random people on the internet asking me whether this was a feasible project. I had my own mother asking me whether this was a feasible project. People want to know about it because it seems like it would make sense. But in the halls of power for Western Water, there is not a lot of conversation about actually bringing this to reality.
All right. So the main focus of your reporting was the idea of a pipeline, right? Like, we have water pipelines, we have gas pipelines and oil pipelines. So it seems like that might be the most feasible solution. But as you reported, there are some pretty significant challenges to making that happen. First, and one of the big ones is, like, how would it actually happen? Like, who would you even try to get the permission from to build this thing?
The political infrastructure to bring this to reality is kind of not there. Water in the West and to an extent in the East is managed by this kind of patchwork of different agencies, different towns and counties and farm districts. And there is no central water agency, oftentimes for a state, and there's definitely no central water agency at the federal level.
Mm-hmm.
So if a Western entity wanted to go and get water from, quote unquote, the East, they wouldn't really have anyone to go to. There's no one there who could just kind of sell off the water. And even if they did have an agency to hand away water from east of here, there is not a lot of likelihood that they would want to. Anywhere in the Mississippi River Basin, which is a sprawling network of rivers that goes from, you know, Montana to Pittsburgh, it basically, you know, the water they have there, they need for farms and for cities and for boating and for birds and fish. And they might not necessarily be willing to give it away because, believe it or not, they have their own droughts too.
Right. So another big challenge, and I think this might be the most obvious one, is money, right? Like, this would be ridiculously expensive to build.
Yeah. Experts I talked to said this project would be so expensive that it wouldn't be worth it because we could spend that money more effectively elsewhere. It is hard to put a number on this just because kind of nothing of this scale has really been attempted. It would be a lot of distance of either canal or pipeline, and it would be moving uphill. And water is incredibly heavy. It takes a lot of water to flow onto farm fields or into a city to be useful. And that amount of water would require a ton of energy to pump against the force of gravity. It probably is too expensive to make sense. And that is even with billions of dollars from the federal government and more money from the state governments focused on fixing this supply-demand water imbalance. But experts are saying we already know of cheaper ways to fix this, like paying farmers not to use water, either temporarily or sort of in a long-term way. But you keep seeing politicians and, you know, other thinkers coming back to this idea because it seems a little simpler than that.
Right. So I would imagine there are also some environmental challenges in terms of building it, probably other legal, like jurisdictional, like where would you actually build the pipeline? Like, what are the other challenges that folks have said, like, yes, this is in theory a great idea, but in practice, maybe not?
Yeah, it would be difficult to engineer, but not impossible. You know, the West is crisscrossed by all kinds of canals and infrastructure to move water. We would not have Phoenix today without the Central Arizona
right.
Project.
Yeah.
Covering 330-odd miles of desert. bringing water from far away to the valley. Same thing goes for Denver and Los Angeles and Albuquerque and Salt Lake City. But this one would be so big that it would be very difficult to pull off because anyone in the way might throw up some opposition. They might put up some red tape and say, we actually don't want this giant new project running through our county or through my private land. And one expert I talked to said, look, we have all of these other smaller pipelines because they were feasible. And the ones that are left are not feasible. There's a reason we haven't built this big cross-country one.
Okay, so if not a pipeline then, are there any other ways to feasibly get water from places that have too much of it to places that don't have enough of it?
The big problem on the Colorado River is we have too much demand and not enough supply. We are able to technologically help solve that equation, but we will not do it with a cross-country pipeline. From what I can tell so far, a lot of that money is going into facilities to recycle water that we already have. Water that comes from showers and kitchen sinks and toilet flushes. We have the technology to purify it so it is drinkable again.
Mm-hmm.
We are more likely to see that happen soon than we are to see a big cross-country pipeline.
I mean, it's one of those things where when you think about it, it makes sense why this is such a challenge. But you see those images of Florida and North Carolina, and then you see images, you know, of like the cracked earth because it's so dry here in the West, and you think to yourself, man, there's got to be a way to make this happen. But as you're saying, there really isn't, at least not one that makes financial sense and even in some cases makes like practical sense.
Yes. Almost all of the experts I talked to said something to that effect. I did talk to one who said we shouldn't completely write it off. He is a retired official with the Bureau of Reclamation, the federal agency that manages Western Water. And believe it or not, in 2012, that federal agency actually looked at bringing an idea like this to reality. They looked at the most reasonable solutions, from finding water kind of near Colorado and piping it across a few hundred miles. They even looked at taking bags of melted icebergs and shipping them from Antarctica to the port of Los Angeles. And they kind of found that they were all not ready for prime time. But this official that I talked to said, look, we have a monumental challenge in front of us, and it took Herculean efforts to wrangle this river and make it useful for the West in the first place. We built the Hoover Dam, and
right.
He was saying it'll take that scale of thinking to get out of today's problems, but I wouldn't expect it to happen anytime soon.
All right. That is Alex Hager of KUNC in Colorado. Alex, nice to see you. Thanks for your conversation.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
The Arizona Supreme Court is under a lot of scrutiny by voters this election. Two justices are the subject of campaigns to get voters to kick them off the court after they voted to uphold an 1864 abortion ban. And a competing initiative is attempting to retroactively keep them on. Now, a story from the Arizona Capital Times is adding a new layer of scrutiny to the court just weeks before the election. Reporter Kira Riley found that the justices buried a finding by their own ethics advisory committee that found two of the justices shouldn't have worn their judicial robes while attending the so-called Red Mass earlier this year. Justices Catherine King and Bill Montgomery attended the event and spoke at it wearing their robes earlier this year. I spoke with Riley more about what happened next.
So the Red Mass is a Roman Catholic gathering. They have it annually, usually in January. It's aimed specifically at attorneys, lawmakers, and judges. It is open to anyone of any religious denomination, but essentially the aim of the gathering is to invoke divine guidance in the coming year as it pertains to lawmaking or the judiciary.
Mm-hmm. So this year, two Arizona Supreme Court justices attended, and there are photos of them wearing their robes, their kind of court robes at the Mass. First of all, tell us, how did they participate in the Red Mass?
So Catherine King gave the first reading, and Montgomery led attorneys in renewing their oath of admission to the State Bar of Arizona. And so, yeah, the photos show them in their robes at the lectern, speaking to the crowd in both those instances.
Tell us a little bit about what comes next, because that's where the story gets really interesting. It seems that this appearance of these two justices at the Red Mass in their robes raised some questions because there was an ethics committee decision that has surfaced since. Tell us about that decision. Do we know who asked the ethics committee to review it?
So no, we don't. But the next day, the day after the Red Mass, they did get a request to kind of look into the ethical implications of wearing an an official judicial robe at a religious service like the Red Mass. The ask, you know, specifically pertain to the Red Mass. We don't know who submitted it because those requests for opinions are confidential and usually pertain to a judge or justice's own conduct. Mm-hmm. And so the ethics committee got this request for an opinion. They discussed it, decided to move forward with issuing a formal opinion, and basically returned a finding that a judge or justice can attend a religious service and fulfill a special role, but they should not do so wearing an official robe. You know, that indicates their job and their government duties and can kind of create an appearance of impropriety or undue influence.
Okay, so let's talk about what happened afterward. The decision comes out from this ethics review committee, and the justices that same day, right, petition for a rule change to allow them to do this differently, to handle it differently. Describe that for us.
So yeah, the opinion came out on June 3rd, and the same day, the administrative office for the courts petitioned the court to change the rules and oversight of the ethics advisory committee and would basically install a review period so that Supreme Court justices could overlook an opinion before it becomes final and before, you know, it gets distributed and published. This ethics opinion was briefly published online, and then the justices did ask the committee to reconsider their finding. And then when it did come back that they found, you know, the same conclusion, the justices then, you know, a few weeks later, voted to adopt this rule that allowed them final review over ethics opinions. And then, you know, a week after that, decided to withdraw the opinion.
So they withdraw this official opinion. What does that mean exactly? Does it mean that it disappears, that it is unsearchable?
So it was, I mean, pulled off the website during reconsideration and then withdrawn entirely after that. And so I think for a little bit, it was just kind of like a note that said, you know, we're reconsidering this opinion. And then, you know, any mention of it is now gone off the website and so inaccessible to whoever may be looking for it. So I got it through a public records request. But when it was withdrawn, they kind of sent a note out to all the judges and justices they distributed it to. And then again, you know, just kind of pulled any mention of it from the website. And so it kind of disappeared in that sense.
Is this common for the justices to withdraw an opinion like this? Have they done this before?
No, I don't think it's unheard of, but it is uncommon. The staff director of the Ethics Advisory Committee called it an anomaly. If an ethics opinion is withdrawn, it's usually done to avoid confusion, misinterpretation, reliance on inaccurate or out-of-date information. But in this case, you know, the justices disagreed with the result, reasoning, and chose to withdraw it on those grounds.
Can you back up for a moment, Kira, and just tell us a little bit about this ethics review committee and like what they're supposed to do, what their role usually is?
Yeah, absolutely. So they are different and distinct from the Commission on Judicial Conduct. The Commission on Judicial Conduct investigates like ethics complaints. The advisory committee kind of takes up different issues and weighs in on how it would fit into our ethics scheme for the judiciary. And so, I mean, in this instance, took up a question about robes at a Red Mass and looked at our existing ethical constructions for judges and justices and proceeded accordingly. In this case, they did issue a formal opinion. They don't always have to do that. If they get a request to weigh in, they can, you know, talk to the person directly, resolve it informally through communication. But, you know, in instances where, you know, they think maybe an issue needs a little more clarification, they'll go forward with a formal opinion and kind of clarify and build upon our ethical canon here.
Okay, so let me ask you lastly, Kira, just to put this into context for us. Like, this comes at a time in which the state Supreme Court, in particular, the U.S. Supreme Court as well, are under a lot of scrutiny. Two of our state Supreme Court justices, including one of the justices at hand here, are the subject of campaigns to have them voted out in November because of decisions that people view as political.
I think we are on the eve of a particularly contentious judicial retention election. There's a lot of attention paid to it, which is not completely new, but I mean, I think definitely we're hitting new heights as we approach this election in terms of campaigning and what have you. We also have Prop 137, mm-hmm. which would kind of change the judicial merit selection and retention system for Arizona and would walk back the results of our 2024 retention election. So it comes on the eve of a lot of big decisions that the voters have to make.
Yeah. And another reason to put more scrutiny on the court, it seems.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Kira Riley, courts and education reporter for the Arizona Capital Times, joining us to talk about her reporting on this. Kira, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody.
The Phoenix Police Department was already in the spotlight before the story of Tyrone McAlpin broke last week. The black man is deaf and has cerebral palsy. Now there is a video of him being beaten and tasered by police in August that is making national headlines. This comes as the Phoenix PD is dealing with the aftermath of a scathing report from the Department of Justice that found a pattern or practice of excessive force and discrimination against people of color. City leaders are trying to work with the DOJ to avoid being put under federal oversight now. But for our next guest this morning, it is put up or shut up time for black leaders here and for anyone who stands against racism, for that matter. Greg Moore is a columnist for the Arizona Republic, and he joins me this morning to talk more about it. Good morning, Greg.
Hey, good morning.
All right. So, Greg, I want to start with your reaction to this video from Phoenix PD body camera. I wonder, like, you say in the column here that you wrote about this, that you do not think anything will change, even though you're making this call to black leaders. Tell us why.
Well, it's not just to black leaders, but I'm starting with them because it's happening with their community. But I'm calling out anybody who feels like they're not a racist, anybody who feels like everybody should be judged by the content of their character, anybody who feels like people are inherently equal and that race is a social construct and that race is not something we should use to judge people. I'm calling everybody out because I'm dealing with a sense of resignation that's actually overwhelming my frustration. Usually these sorts of things happen and I get angry and I want to make change. And now I'm just like, yep, that's about what happens out here.
Wow. Wow. So you talk about the history of this as well and some of the other cases with specifically Phoenix PD that reminded you of this.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to just keep it strictly to Phoenix PD, right? But George Floyd's family was calling for an investigation. Mm-hmm. Well, Deion Johnson was killed the same day George Floyd was, and that was a state trooper. There was a kid, 17-year-old kid, got killed by a police officer. His name was Amarian Hope. I don't think anybody even knows his name. And we can go all the way back to Michelle Crusoe in 2014. That was Phoenix PD. She had a disability. She was, I believe, bipolar and schizophrenic and was kind of having an episode in her own home. Police tried to enter after having been called. She wouldn't let them in. They kind of barged their way in. She was inside holding a hammer in sort of a threatening way, and they just shot her dead. And that was in 2014. And in the interim, we've had this, you know, federal investigation. And I just wonder, why is it that black people tend to get shot so much in confrontations that could otherwise be de-escalated? Why does that keep happening? And the only parallel that I can draw in the cases is that they are black and the officers are not. And it makes me wonder whether black people are seen as human or as somehow, some way, not deserving of normal, everyday, average considerations. Don't shoot them. Wait for them to calm down. Don't shoot them. Figure out another way. I don't know. We'll see if anything changes. I'm not expecting it.
Resignation is an interesting term you use there. Yeah. So, Greg, let's talk about this in light of what's happening with the Phoenix PD and the DOJ right now. As I said, the mayor, several city leaders have said they do not want what's called a consent decree here. They don't want to be under federal oversight for an untold number of years. They can take a long time, cost a lot of money. What's your reaction to that, though? They think, and Phoenix PD has said a lot recently, that they can kind of do it on their own, that they are already making the changes needed.
Well, so I get that. And just think about it in just normal everyday terms. Let's say you had your kids in school and they were having some troubles and somebody said, well, I'm gonna take over your child rearing, and everything you do, you have to report to me and you have to fill out forms and you have to come in for meetings. It's burdensome, it's frustrating, it's embarrassing. It probably is costly. And I can understand why anybody who was in that kind of situation wouldn't want that. But what else are we gonna do, right? Like, the Phoenix PD, that report showed patterns and practices of abuses against Black people, Latinos, Native Americans. It showed that abuse was pervasive. It showed lots of problems that, you know, if you've got a plan to fix it, then fix it. But if it's not getting fixed, something must be done. So two things are true. I understand where police and city leaders are coming from. I probably wouldn't want that either if I were in a similar situation. But this isn't working, so something needs to be done.
So, Greg, I think an interesting point you make in this column is that you say you can support police and oppose police brutality, which seems to be a dichotomy many people are having trouble striking these days, especially in the political spectrum. We heard from the major police union plea last week as well, saying that these charges, which have now been dropped against Tyrone McAlpin, should not have been, that this was an example of bias against police, that the officers were just defending themselves against an attack from him. I wonder how you think that's possible in this day and age today, saying that, you know, we can do both of these things.
So the only way it's going to work is if reasonable people all stand up and everybody says, hey, guys, this isn't working. If the afflicted community is the only community raising a fuss, then there's not going to be much change. And so really, I'm wondering where all the allies are right now. I'm wondering where are the Black leaders to galvanize those allies? And I think that too much in our society, but particularly in our politics, and this issue has become political, we're all or nothing. And I just don't think that that's the right way to be. It doesn't seem to me unreasonable at all to say, yes, we need police. Yes, it's a hard job. Yes, it's a dangerous job. Let's make it easier for them to do their jobs, but also let's make sure they're actually protecting the communities. I wasn't there when the McAlpin thing happened, obviously. I'd love to hear more of the police side of it. The problem is, when I hear the police sides of things, they sound so similar that I don't trust the answer. It sounds like a doctored answer, maybe from a lawyer, maybe from a union. Oh, he was posing a threat. He was really strong. I just don't believe it anymore because I've heard it so many times in so many cases in so many ways. Please forgive the frustration in my voice. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the Mike Brown case. Was the first time I can recall hearing, some of these descriptions. But how could it possibly be the same thing so often? I just don't trust or believe the answer. And so I do think it is totally reasonable to say we need police. Police serve a valuable function. We appreciate what they're doing for us, but sometimes it goes too far, and that's what we have to stop. I don't see it as an all or nothing proposition.
All right. We'll leave it there for this morning. Greg Moore, columnist with the Arizona Republic, joining us. Greg, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Fighting in the Middle East continues on multiple fronts as the conflicts between Israel and Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon continue. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. And Rob, where are we right now and what might we expect this week?
Yes, so there's so much going on in the Middle East. At the moment, as there has been for, you know, months, but particularly right now, there's just on every front, there's something happening. So, for example, President Joe Biden's special envoy to Lebanon was there today, and he's been saying that all parties to the conflict there are working on producing a formula that brings an end to the conflict once and for all. So that's the conflict between Israel and the Hezbollah movement in Lebanon. Meanwhile, Israeli strikes on Lebanon continued despite his visit. So there were overnight attacks targeting branches of a bank, essentially, of a financial institution, which the Israelis accuse of helping Hezbollah purchase weapons. So their accusation is that money from Iran, which backs Hezbollah, is being sort of filtered into that bank. And that money is then being used to purchase weapons, which are then being used by Hezbollah against Israel. So all of that's going on this, on the sort of Lebanese front, and the attacks continue across that, across the country. At the same time, we have Israel really focusing on northern Gaza at the moment. Why? Because they, that area was largely evacuated. But they think that Hamas is regrouping in that area. So there have been a number of attacks. There was one really severe one over the weekend in which it's estimated that 87 people were killed. That's according to the Hamas authorities. Israel, of course, says it's going after Hamas groups and not civilians. But it's clear that some civilians have been caught in this. Now, all of this is on the back, of course, of the Hamas leader being killed last week, which some people think is potentially an opening for some sort of an agreement or a settlement, or at least some sort of way forward in all of these conflicts. I should just say there's one little footnote, which is of great interest, I think, which is that Israeli police in the last couple of hours say they've dismantled a spy network which was gathering intelligence for Iran. The police say that there were 7 Israeli members of that network arrested in Israel, and that they were, police say, said some were arrested while spying on an Israeli citizen who Iran was allegedly planning to harm. So I think we'll see that kind of rise up through the headlines in the coming hours. But yes, lots going on in the Middle East.
Interesting. All right, Rob, let's go now to Japan, which is holding a general election next weekend. What's the significance of this one?
Well, in Japan, which of course has, 125 million people, of course, is the third largest economy in the world, a very important country. What we've had over the summer is a change of leadership of the Liberal Democratic Party, which is the LDP, which is the dominant party in Japan, has been for decades, even though occasionally it's been out of power. But we saw a change in leadership and a new leader to that party come in. His name is Shigeru Ishiba. And because the party enjoys a majority, he also became prime minister. However, this was back in September. However, 3 days after he was declared prime minister, he called a snap election, general election, and that will be held this coming Sunday. So we're looking ahead to that. The reason he says is because, quote, it's important for the new administration to be judged by the people as soon as possible. So clearly he wants kind of his own mandate from the public, not just from the party. So that's interesting. That's a general election. I should just say that Japan has been mired in scandals in the past few months. This is what led to the change of leadership of the dominant party. This is what's led to the new prime minister coming along. So including, by the way, links with the Unification Church, what some people refer to as the Moonies, which caused all sorts of controversy in Japan, but a bunch of other scandals as well. And that's why we have a new leader in Japan, and that's why we have an election this Sunday.
All right. So, Rob, let's finish up with an interesting court case at London's High Court this week featuring Brazil, the environment, and thousands of plaintiffs. What's going on here?
This is an extraordinary story. It's the biggest mass lawsuit in British history. And you might think, well, hang on, what's Britain got to do with this? This is something that happened in Brazil. Indeed, it did. So back in 2015, 9 years ago, a huge dam collapsed in the southeast of Brazil. It killed around 19 people, but it also affected nature. So it got into the waterways. This is, we're talking about toxic wastewater and sludge here. There are some reports that it traveled 415 or 420 miles along the waterways as far as the Atlantic Ocean and had a huge effect. In fact, it's referred to in Brazil as the country's worst ever environmental disaster. So a terrible thing happened in 2015. What we now have is upwards of 620,000 individuals, Brazilians, 46 Brazilian municipalities or local councils, if you like, 2,000 businesses, 65 faith-based institutions. They are all claiming damages against one of the world's largest mining conglomerates, BHP, who, with their partners, were essentially responsible for this mine. So we're seeing that. That's why we're seeing it in the British High Court, largely because BHP was headquartered in Britain at the time. But we're also seeing a similar parallel court case in the Netherlands as well. But it's a huge court case, massive environmental disaster, and as I say, the largest mass lawsuit in British history.
Well, that is really interesting. All right, that is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. Rob, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. Along with Mark Brody, I am Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Every morning before work, I give myself a little just a little spritz from a bottle marked bourbon vanilla. Now, I've never really given very much thought to why I do this, but I do know that I'm not alone. Countless people put on some sort of intentional scent before they head out into the world. Maybe you did this morning. Well, Saskia Wilson-Brown has thought a lot about this. She is the founder and executive director of the Institute for Art and Olfaction, an organization dedicated to expanding public awareness about the culture of smell. She and her team are particularly interested in the work of independent, artisan, and experimental practices when it comes to scent. And their work dovetails with a recent New York Times report on the booming market for alternative perfumes. As the Times put it, quote, although the mainstream perfume business has long run on seduction, celebrity, and the idea that a person must have a signature scent, a burgeoning counter movement driven by independent artisans is questioning the idea that a perfume's central function is to delight the noses of others. When I asked Saskia what she made of that report, she told me that much of this experimental spirit can be traced to an internet culture that encourages people to re-examine preconceived notions about all sorts of human expression, from music to movies to colognes and perfumes.
The folks that started examining perfume started to rightfully question why it was that we were all meant to wear flowers if we were girls, and whatever, resins if we were boys, and started to re-examine that completely by making scents that were designed only to delight themselves and their own curiosities and their own sense of self.
Do you wear perfume yourself?
I wear multiple perfumes all the time.
What are some of your favorite scents to wear?
You know, I've been really interested in some fragrances that are, I guess, considered maybe a little bit odd from a classical perspective, like a brand called Beaufort London. All of his scents have this very specific aesthetic, which is a little bit dark wave, if I could describe it in one word. Okay. They're a little bit smoky and a little bit rough. And I wouldn't say that they're pretty, but they're definitely interesting.
When you put on, say, a dark wave scent like that, do you think you could describe the conscious effect it has on you? I ask because I started wearing cologne at some point because I associated it with a sense of a certain type of man that I thought I wanted to be.
Well, totally.
Who was like finished. You know what I mean? It was around the time that I started thinking, you know, I should get my hair cut every 6 weeks and I should wear collared shirts every day. And there was something about cologne that felt like the last step in that process.
100%. And so I echo that narrative. You know, when I was a young teenage girl, I sort of started to think, oh, like what is a woman? You know, what does a woman wear? And I also had the same narrative as you. Or the same thought process as you. You know, you wear certain clothes and at some point you put on a perfume because that's what the ladies smell like and you want to be a lady, you know. So, you know, I mean, as we age and our sense of identity evolves, you know, we get to explore different aspects of ourselves. So for me, wearing something by Beaufort is wearing something that explores a different aspect of my personality. It also conveys something different to the people around me versus, oh, I want to be a lady and I want you to think I'm attractive. It says, hey, I'm a complex being with stormy brains or whatever. I mean,
it can
say all sorts of things that are a little bit more complex than, oh, look at me, I'm a pretty girl.
You know what I'm just realizing as we're talking about this, and I wonder if you have any relationship with this, is I think maybe on some level, I don't know if it was conscious, but the reason that I started wearing cologne is it almost strikes me as a way to be remembered. People remember the smells of places they've been or foods they liked or, you know, things that they have a positive relationship with. And I think on some level it occurred to me that if somebody remembered, oh yeah, I met that guy once, he smelled good.
Yeah.
It might be, they might be less quick to forget me.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, isn't all human expression a desire not to be forgotten, you know?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, one's sense of smell and what smells good to someone is extremely personal and is built out of a whole host of factors. What are some of the things that go into what we respond to favorably when we smell something that we're maybe not thinking about when we have a positive reaction?
I think the thing we most commonly don't think about is how culture plays its part, you know. So in some cultures, you know, for instance, the smell of the body is more accepted than others, you know, and in the US in particular, we've been sort of marketed deodorants from the early 20th century. And that marketing strategy was built on giving, I mean, overtly and admittedly built on instilling in people a sense of shame about how they smelled. I think people forget that. And a lot of the narratives around what smells good and smells bad, if you pick them apart, you know, you definitely come down to, you know, othering. When you have a dominant culture and you have a culture that is, you know, perceived as lesser by that dominant culture, oftentimes that language is spoken through smell. Those people smell bad. Their food smells bad. They don't wash, blah, blah, blah. But if you just take a little bit of a curious nose to that and you remove the judgment, which you observe is this is just a smell, you know, there's nothing wrong with any smell. It's just how you react to it, really.
Well, so, I think a lot of that history and reality helps explain things like floral scents that were associated with women and maybe like, I don't know, earthier, muskier forms of cologne that men used to wear. But let's talk a little bit about the journey from those to some of the fragrances that we can find now. You were alluding to one earlier with the Beaufort line.
Mm-hmm.
I was just looking up a couple here that I wanted to run by you. One is a scent called Inexcusable Evil.
By Tuscovet.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, so you're familiar.
Oh, okay. I'm familiar. Oh, yes.
It says the top notes are gunpowder and ozone. The heart notes are blood, bandages, iodine, burning flowers, fallen concrete, rain, incense, and sandalwood. Talk a little bit about the thought process in assembling a scent like that.
Well, I mean, this particular perfume was assembled as a sort of political statement as to, you know, to what's going on in the world. Human misbehavior, war, evil, you know, what we do to each other. And all the scents, all the scent notes that you describe are designed to elucidate that. It's a political and it's an artistic statement. And it's not always pleasant, much like art isn't always pleasant, but it makes a point.
Right. It's kind of an audacious idea, the idea that you would wear a scent like this. And it, you know, it's doubtful, I would imagine, that you could walk up to somebody wearing Inexcusable Evil and stand next to them and say, is that the smell of fallen concrete? Boy, there's a lot of genocide happening, you know?
Yeah, I mean, not your common perfume narrative, for sure.
but I could imagine standing next to somebody wearing that and having them say, I'm so sorry, that scent you're wearing is so interesting, tell me more about it. And then that becomes an invitation to have that conversation.
Exactly. And so the perfumer, whose name is David Love, is from Romania. And that was the point.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one more I wanted to run by you is called Funerie, and this is by Pinewood Perfume.
Yeah.
And the scent notes here are rites of the dead, a shroud of bleakness, feasting fungi and wilted roses nestle atop charred pine boards and a base of heavy resins, morel mushroom, decayed rose, blood cedar, rotting wood. What do you make of wanting to evoke death?
Yeah, well, so I think that death is a reality. And I think that traditionally in perfumery, we would have done everything to avoid that reality because, you know, who wants to be confronted with death? We'd rather just smell nice. So there's this sort of small subset of indie perfumes that explore death, typically in metaphor, as this one does, I might add, because the real smell of death is not in this fragrance. I can guarantee you that.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's just like it's humans making sense of our human condition, you know, with all the tools we have at our disposal. And I think it's cool that perfume has evolved to the point where we can do that now.
Yes. But it just occurs to me, based on what you said, that even in a scent like Funerie, we still can't resist romanticizing it.
Absolutely. I mean, this is definitely the realm of metaphor. At least that's what I'd say perfumers hope, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, religion, power, sensuality, you name it. It all has an olfactory narrative.
All right. Well, Saskia Wilson Brown is the founder and executive director of the Institute for Art and Olfaction and the host of the Perfume on the Radio radio show. Saskia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.